Good morning. We have had a little change in the schedule. Governor Chris is in the building. However, he will not be down for a few minutes, so we're going to switch a couple of the speakers early on here. But before we get started, I want to underscore what we believe is the objective for this conference, and that is really to stake out some common ground between different points of view. Common ground is particularly important in the political arena, because until the leaders of the two political parties decide that they're prepared to compromise, to strike the compromise between individual and collective responsibility that's inevitable, not much is going to happen in way of progress on reform. But in terms of the way this conference will go forward, when I play this role, I always like to make these conferences as interoperative as possible. So we want you to be part of the dialogue, challenging the speakers with your questions and with your points of view. To that end, we're going to be asking each of the panel speakers to address two questions. What are your three priorities for health care reform? And two, what are the major obstacles to achieving those reform goals? During the conference, we will be passing out to the audience a participant survey that asks these same questions. We recognize that not all of the knowledge resides up here on the stage, for sure, and that you and the audience should participate fully in these survey questions. After the conference, the sponsors, the White House Writers Group and the West Wing Writers, will be taking all of the items that are discussed, the challenges that are broached, and weaving it together into a white paper that will serve as a useful tool going forward in relation to reform. So be sure that we get your input as well. With that, I would like to introduce our first speaker, Ivan Seidenberg, who is the CEO and chairman of Verizon, which he has led since its creation in the year 2000. But today he's also wearing another important hat as chairman of the Consumer Health and Retirement Initiative of the Business Roundtable. As you know, the Roundtable is a collection of the nation's CEOs of the nation's largest corporations, and thus a strong and an influential voice in the directions that health policy will take. So with that, please join me in welcoming Mr. Seidenberg.
Okay, good morning. Good morning. Thank you, John, and thank you for inviting me here today, and good morning to all you distinguished guests here at the conference. I didn't plan to be the warm-up act for the governor, but this will be an interesting opportunity to actually precede him and try to figure out what he might have said anyway to lead off this conference. So as you heard, I'm here representing Verizon, and as you know, Verizon is one of the largest employers in the country, and I'm also here representing the Business Roundtable as John just mentioned, just quickly, the Business Roundtable, 160 member companies, 75 of the largest 200 corporations in America. And so we have a unique perspective and interest in this entire healthcare issue as we go forward. So our corporate stake in reforming America's healthcare system should be clear to everybody. More than two out of every three Americans, about 177 million people, currently receive health insurance through their employer. Verizon alone provides health insurance for over 900,000 employees, retirees, and family members at a cost just to our company of a little under $4 billion a year. So in many important respects, I think we would all agree the American health care system is really among the best in the world. When it comes to scientific advances, medical technology, and the quality of our doctors and medical institutions, the U.S. is without peer. But our country's health care system is becoming increasingly expensive and burdensome to businesses and families. Costs that, without some restructuring of the system, will put the benefits of this amazing medical expertise beyond the reach of an increasing number of Americans. Business Roundtable CEOs consistently cite healthcare as their number one cost pressure. Rampant cost increases in the medical system mean we're paying more but receiving less value. More than 45 million Americans have opted out of the system, a number you are all well aware of, either by choice or by necessity, leaving employer-sponsored plans to subsidize those who fall through the cracks. With most Americans' health benefits tied to their jobs, people worry that they won't be able to afford coverage for their families if they move to a new job, retire early, or they want to start their own business. American businesses are paying a steep price for an unsustainable, somewhat uneconomic, health care system. Now, from our perspective, the major problem with the health care market in this country is that it doesn't really function as a market, leaving major consumer needs unmet, costs unchecked by competition, and basic practices untouched by the productivity revolution that has transformed every other sector of our economy. So something I know about, contrast that to the communications business, for example, where we've seen technology and competition invigorate our business and ignite innovation. Information technology has revolutionized the interface between customers and providers. And the norms of the electronic marketplace, the personalization of information, customer control over purchase of products and services, price transparency, and 24/7 availability, the internet, for example, have become part of the customer's expectation in just about every aspect of life. Everywhere, it seems, except in healthcare. Healthcare delivery needs a new business model, one that puts customers in the center and uses the power of the market to lower costs, improve quality, create more consumer choice, and expand accessibility. The Business Roundtable has an approach that we believe will put us on a path to a new business model. Our plan, which we announced yesterday, rests on four pillars. Just quickly, they are creating greater consumer value, meaning that we drive a lot of efficiency and expanded products and services, providing more affordable health insurance options for all Americans, placing an obligation on all Americans to have health insurance coverage. Everybody registers, everybody plays. And fourth, offering assistance where necessary to the uninsured, lower-income families that need a safety net. So let me say a word about each one of these four things quickly. First, we need to create more value for the healthcare consumer. The defining feature of the information age economy is that the customer is in charge. Communications technology puts information about price, quality, and choice at consumers' fingertips and empowers them to choose their products and services with the touch of a button, for example. But the consumer revolution has not yet taken place as much as we'd like in healthcare. The fact is, it's easier to find out the cost of repairing the valves in your car engine than the valves in your heart. For that matter, it's somewhat easier to learn about the quality of your auto mechanic than it is your surgeon or even the hospital that you go to. The BRT recommends several actions to empower consumers to take charge of their own health and use technology to make the system a lot more efficient. Consumers and insurers need more transparency and wider distribution of consistent information about the cost, quality, and effectiveness of the healthcare services they purchase. This will make the market function better, create better healthcare consumers, and improve the quality of medical care. The current reimbursement system pays for activity, not necessarily outcomes. Private employers like us have tried to fix this through various partnerships and programs, but to get meaningful change, we need all payers, including the federal government, to be included in the process. Therefore, the Medicare payment structure, for example, needs to be changed to a pay-for-performance system that rewards value, not activity. The most egregious flaw that we see in the current healthcare delivery system model is the woeful rate of adoption of information technology, which means that healthcare has failed to capitalize on a productivity revolution that has transformed just about every other sector of our economy. We estimate that health IT can save $165, $170 billion a year annually, reduce medical errors, and usher the healthcare delivery system into the 21st century. Regardless of whatever industry sector you look at, a heavy dose of IT technology into any industry generally produces 25 to 35% productivity improvements over a 3 to 5 year period. Guaranteed, happens every time. The good news is we can do something about this, and we can do it immediately. Today, the U.S. Senate has before it the bipartisan Wired for Healthcare Quality Act, sponsored by Senators Kennedy and Enzi, which would establish the uniform, interoperable standards we need to create an improved system. A similar bill is pending in the House. Passage of this legislation is the Business Roundtable's number one healthcare priority for the remainder of this session of Congress and throughout, hopefully, the next several months. It's a very, very good first step. We can and must do this now because the BRT certainly urges and challenges the U.S. Congress to put aside whatever partisan politics there is here and make this happen before they go home to campaign for re-election. So, now, the first step to reform is to put the consumer in the driver's seat, as we could with more information technology. The next step is to create a functional private insurance market that offers consumers greater choice in health coverage. So we believe that competition and innovation can be a very powerful weapon in the fight to provide every American reliable, affordable insurance. So from our view, why aren't these forces operating in the market right now? Well, the answer has to do with the structure of the market itself. State by state, overly prescriptive, and afflicted with dueling mandates, rules, and regulations. In the communications business, we learned firsthand how an inflexible regulatory structure can inhibit competition, and conversely, how opening up the market can unleash innovation and investment to the benefit of consumers and the economy as a whole. 5 years ago, you had high cellular rates because the system was geared to very local areas to run your system. As we consolidated and created a national market, you can call anywhere in the country for the lowest rate, and now you can call anywhere in the world for low rates. So as we restructure the business and take it away from local control and create more national markets, the consumer ends up with the beneficiary of all this kind of change. So we believe the same thing can happen in healthcare. We'd like to break down the barriers to innovation by creating an open, all-inclusive market for health insurance. From the BRT's perspective, the current state-based system would be replaced by a multi-state market so insurers could sell their products to individuals, small and large employers across a much larger area. The Department of Health and Human Services, for example, would establish the regions and create minimum standards so that insurers would have one set of rules, not 50, when it comes to designing their products. We know this multi-state model works. Employers provide insurance to 177 million employees, irrespective of state boundaries. Another example is that the Medicare prescription drug bill, which has lowered costs and increased the variety of prescription plans far more than people would have thought, is also based on a national model. The result of this reform will be a more rational insurance system that encourages new competitors to enter the market with a wider variety of insurance products. Consumers will have more power to shop for the policy that suits their needs, and the expanded pools will spread risk, lower costs, and permit greater mobility for consumers. You can move from job to job, state to state, not lose your plan. A big step forward, we believe, towards a sustainable, affordable, and portable system of health insurance that American consumers want. The third pillar of our plan is requiring every American to accept the obligation to have health care coverage, either through their employer or through the private market, which today some 45 million Americans do not. Reducing that number does not lend itself to a one-size-fits-all solution. That's because the uninsured group, this 45 million, is far from monolithic. There are estimates that would suggest that between 4 and 5 million of this 45 million are college students, 8 to 10 million are non-citizens, more than 8 million are eligible for assistance programs such as Medicaid or SCHIP but have not enrolled, and more than 9 million households' incomes have incomes of more than $75,000. Even if these numbers aren't exactly right, they are clearly directionally correct as we look at all of this data. As these numbers indicate, the problem for many uninsured Americans in obtaining coverage isn't so much financial as it is structural. If we are going to require consumers to buy coverage, we need to have a competitive system that provides them with the affordable options suitable for their families. A more functional private insurance market that encourages insurers to innovate around the needs of these consumers will go a long way toward filling these holes in the safety net. And finally, the fourth pillar is assistance for lower income families. Now, for some, we all recognize that lower income uninsured families need the kind of safety net that should be provided by our system. So under the Business Roundtable's approach, the government would provide financial assistance so that low-income individuals and families can purchase coverage from the private market. These targeted subsidies would be funded from the cost savings that will be generated by a more competitive and efficient healthcare system and by the larger risk pools that would be created because everybody would be in the system with some form of coverage. The government, after all, is the country's largest purchaser of healthcare services. The potential savings from adopting healthcare IT and such programs as Medicare are just immense, savings that can be captured and used to achieve the important policy goal of making sure every American can afford the health insurance that they need. The Business Roundtable plan is our attempt to use the power of the market to drive down costs, drive up quality, and improve access to healthcare for everyone. You might think of this as the business perspective on this issue. But in fact, this goes beyond what's good for Verizon, the Business Roundtable, or even the millions of Americans who rely on their employers for insurance. The challenge of reforming the healthcare system goes to the very heart of American competitiveness and innovation. So when Americans are afraid to switch jobs or start their own business for fear of losing their health insurance, when American-made products carry a healthcare premium that foreign-made goods do not, when American healthcare delivery system is not leading the world in technological innovation in delivering services, and when year after year we're spending more money and getting less value, then America's very place in the global economy is at risk. It will take a broad coalition of interests from across the political spectrum to achieve the kind of systemic reform that we all need. Every constituency represented in this room today must be a part of the overall solution. The Business Roundtable is committed to being part of the solution, and we're working with groups like the AARP, SEIU, and the National Federation of Independent Businesses in the Divided We Fail Coalition to see this through to the finish line. We do understand there are many perspectives on this issue and many facets to the problem, but we deeply believe that true reform of the healthcare system must emerge from the uniquely American principles that drive our economy, which is innovation, competition, choice, and a market that serves everybody. You can be assured that we at the Business Roundtable care deeply about this issue, and we will put our effort and our energy to participate in this dialogue. We greatly appreciate you conducting this conference and offering us an opportunity to share our views. And we wish you well and great success in finding answers to these important questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Seidenberg, for opening our conference and an eloquent set of remarks. I'd like to move right on in hopes of getting back on schedule. By introducing Dr. Anthony Rankin, who will introduce the governor. Dr. Rankin is a neighbor in the Maryland suburbs, but more importantly, president of the American Association of Orthopedic Surgeons, which is a driving force behind the original sponsorship of this conference, the Doctors for Medical Liability Reform, an association of medical specialists. Early on, this group of specialists realized that real progress would be made only if divergent groups came together and struck the necessary compromises to make progress on reform. So with that, Dr. Rankin.
Good morning. As president of the American Association of Orthopedic Surgeons, I can assure you that the orthopedic surgeons have been very actively involved in issues of healthcare reform since the early 90s. And this conference, as John pointed out, had its genesis in our participation as the chair of the Doctors for Medical Liability Reform. We believe that the critical issues of healthcare reform must be addressed in a nonpartisan approach, and we are delighted that so many of the stakeholders are here with us today. We had an exciting kickoff to this conference last evening, and we look forward to our next presentation to be given by Florida Governor Charlie Crist. Florida is a leader in biomedical innovation, consumer-driven health care, and Medicaid reform. Despite these advances, health insurance, including prescription medications, is often still unaffordable. Since his inauguration as Florida's 44th governor on the 2nd of January 2007, Governor Crist has aimed to improve health care in the state of Florida through initiatives that would make health care more affordable by leveraging the power of Floridians to negotiate better prices for prescription drugs, improve access to care by increasing health care options so that emergency care is not the only choice, strengthening health in the rural communities and increasing the quality of emergency care, advocating for a commitment to prevention, and improving the quality of care through innovation. Additionally, understanding excess weight, sedentary lifestyles, poor eating habits, and associated chronic diseases are plaguing our nation, Governor Crist established the Governor's Council on Physical Fitness to educate and encourage Floridians about leading healthy and active lifestyles. Here to provide a unique state perspective on health care reform, I'd like to introduce Florida Governor Charlie Crist.
Morning. Well, it's great to be here again. I was here last night. Some of you probably were as well. I want to thank the doctor for his kind introduction and his kind words, and I want to welcome all of you to Florida. If you would, how many here are from Florida? Please raise your hand. Excellent. How many are from New York? Oh, boy. How about Pennsylvania? Good. Welcome. Listen, as the governor of Florida, if I don't welcome you here, nobody's going to. So it's good to have you here. I'm going to shed the coat, if you don't mind. We're talking about health care, and I have a great partner in being able to provide better health care for the people of Florida. Is Dr. Peden with us this morning, Durell Peden? Senator Durell Peden. Senator has been a real champion for health care in Florida and health care expansion, and without the help of great members of our Florida Senate and our Florida House, any ideas that we and the administration might have or that the members of the legislature might have just don't come to fruition. They come up with an idea and put it into a bill, and if I don't sign it, it doesn't happen. Our administration comes up with an idea to put into a bill, and if they don't vote for it, it doesn't happen. So I'm very, very grateful to Senator Peden and his colleagues in the Florida Senate and the Florida House for their great leadership and their great work and their spirit of working together. It's something I'm going to touch on in a few minutes. I hope that you will stay in Florida throughout the weekend if you're not from here and enjoy Disney and Universal and other things, Troy, that Central Florida has from our friends from the Panhandle part of the state. But it's a great time to be here. There's lots of good deals. And while you're here, spend a lot of dough. Healthcare, as all of you know, is an issue that touches every single one of us and every single family. Secretary Benson, forgive me for not recognizing you. Please stand. Secretary of our Department of Holly Benson, Agency for Healthcare Administration, ACA. I'm not an acronym guy, so I don't really warm up to that stuff too much, but Holly makes it a lot easier to do so. And Bill Cotterell, my friend Bill from the Tallahassee Democrat, one of the most enterprising journalists in Florida. It's true. I mean, gets in his car and schleps down here from Tallahassee to cover this important issue. Thank you, Bill, because Without dedicated journalists like himself and those in the back, I'm sure, we wouldn't have the opportunity to let the people of Florida know what's going on, the good news that is happening in health care in our state. We now require physical education. I ran for governor in 2006 with a great guy named Jeff Kottkamp. And during the course of the campaign, we went all over the state, as you might imagine, went to a lot of schools, and we found that in these schools, physical education was not being offered anymore, PE, as it was known when I was in school. And when I was in school, back in the Stone Age here in Florida, we had physical education every day, every grade, every day. And as we traveled the state, we saw, regrettably, a lot of obese children and a lot of children that were out of shape otherwise, and there was no physical education being offered. So, you know, I'm a straightforward kind of guy, and I just wanted to try to offer something that was not expensive but that made common sense. And the common sense notion that we came up with was, why not physical education back in our schools? And again, because of our great Florida legislature, we had the opportunity to get that passed in our first session in the spring of 2007 to have physical education back in elementary school. The great legislature extended that to middle schools this past year, and we're working toward doing so in high schools for our next session. But it just makes common sense to me that, you know, if you eat less and move more, you can do a lot better in terms of staying in shape, stem the tide of diabetes, obesity in our children, and have a much healthier Florida and maybe a model for America. We've also made it possible for Floridians to receive discounts on their prescription drugs. God bless you. And that's pretty important, too. So I pause whenever that happens. We have the Florida Discount Drug Card in our state, something that our administration initiated. And I want to read you some statistics. People can get their prescription drugs much more cheaply now. 52,000 Floridians in the past 8 months alone have signed up for the Florida Discount Drug Card, saving over $1 million to receive their prescription drugs. And it really costs the state nothing. It's just good, honest competition that we offer really a window of opportunity to people once they go to the website and see it. I also had the privilege earlier this year, again because of the Florida legislature and people in our administration working very hard, to sign a bill that provides health care coverage to about the 3.8 million Floridians who currently don't have any health care coverage. And I'm very proud of it. I'm very proud of our administration, people that worked incredibly hard, like Lori Rowe. Lori, would you please stand and be recognized? She's an incredible public servant. And Lori, I don't know, is David Foy with us today? He could not be here today, but I guarantee you he's working for you in Tallahassee, and he was instrumental in this as well because he's like an insurance expert. Lori's just a brilliant human being and a great lawyer. And through their negotiating skill, they were able to put forward this plan called Cover Florida. Cover Florida is the name of the plan, and I'm very proud that I was able to sign the bill, and I'll give you some more detail about it. Another issue related to health care that we were able to achieve this past legislative session, for the first time in the history of Florida, provides coverage for autism. And that happened literally in the last minute of the last day of the legislative session. And one of the things that I have learned is when you check your ego at the door and you don't mind who gets the credit or sharing the credit with everybody, what you can accomplish for the people of our state. And that's really the way we ought to operate. I know it's an election year. We had a stimulating conversation last night with James Carville and Karl Rove, two very divergent points of view, which is healthy. It's great for America to see that and have choice. But the fact of the matter is, once those elections are over, we have a duty. We have a duty. I took an oath on January 2, 2007. I took an oath when I was sworn in as Florida's 44th governor to be the governor for all the people of this state, not just the governor for the Republicans, not just the governor for the Democrats or the Independents. I happen to be a Republican. But to be the governor for all the people. And our administration takes that charge very seriously and that oath to heart. I gave that oath to God, so I better. And I think it's important that what's happening in Florida and the success that we have been able to achieve, I believe, is due in large measure because of the fact that we do work together, Republicans and Democrats and Independents, to uphold that oath and to provide good policy for the people of Florida. Let me talk about Cover Florida for a minute. Currently, 1 in 5 Floridians will go to sleep at night and not have health care coverage. 1 in 5. And, you know, we have almost 20 million people that live in this state now. We are the 4th largest state in America, soon to be the 3rd. Some experts tell me that by 2010, we will surpass New York as the 3rd largest state in the country. As a result of that, you know, when there's a percentage that aren't receiving health care coverage, it's a lot of people, an awful lot of people. So I heard these numbers and these statistics, and it bothered my conscience and it bothered my heart. And I felt like what we needed to do was change things and make a difference. And with the help of Senator Peden and others in the legislature, we have done that. So what does Cover Florida do? Cover Florida says we're going to have competition, that our administration will have the authority, because the legislature gave it to us, to negotiate with health insurance companies. And to the health insurance companies' great credit, to their great credit, they are competing. 9 of them have already signed up to compete, offer health care plans to our fellow Floridians that can be as low as $150 per month instead of $700 or $800 per month, which is about the current average. That's a significant saving, Joe, and it helps people. And again, that's why we're here. You know, people who don't have health care coverage worry. They worry for their children. They worry for themselves. They worry for their families. Because if they have one catastrophic event, they don't know how they're going to pay for it. And they don't know how they're going to survive it. Especially this week, it's very timely. During challenging economic times, if you don't have that kind of coverage, you have worry. People shouldn't have to worry. My friends, we live in the richest country in the world. The richest country in the history of the world. And we don't provide health care coverage to our citizens. That's remarkable to me. And we can do it in a free market way. What we're doing in Florida through Cover Florida doesn't cost the taxpayer a dime. All we have to do in the administration and with our friends in the legislature is work a little harder, put in a little more extra effort. I know that Lori and David certainly are, and we talk constantly, and so is Secretary Benson. And as a result, we're going to be able to offer to people as early as January of 2009 the opportunity for these 3.8 million Floridians who don't have coverage the chance to be able to buy it at an affordable rate. And that's what we're supposed to do. Let me share a personal story about how this came to my attention. There's a couple that lives in North Florida, Cindy and Dan Perrone. Cindy sent me an email not long ago, and she told me that their small business, it's an air conditioning company, their small business has 12 employees, 12, and they haven't had insurance for themselves or their employees for 21 years, simply because they couldn't afford it. It was just too expensive. And so, you know, when I talk to people in our administration that are experts in insurance, experts in finance, you know, I sort of view my role, I used to play quarterback a long time ago, and I view my role as being the quarterback, and I need to call plays and give the ball to the experts to get down the field, like Lori and David Foy and Secretary Benson and Senator Peden and others. And so I have to have the wisdom and the judgment to know who to give the ball to on any given play so that we continue to make progress for our people. And fortunately, we've been able to do that. And now Cindy and Dan Perrone and their small business in January are going to be able to have a health care plan that will cover their people. What will Cover Florida cover? It will cover preventive services, screenings, office visits, outpatient and inpatient surgery, urgent care, prescription drugs, and in some cases, catastrophic coverage, because it will offer a range of choices. Now, obviously, the ones that cover catastrophic are going to be a little more expensive, but that's okay. And if people can't afford it, they can afford something less and at least have peace of mind. At least go to bed at night and know that if something difficult happens to them or one of their family members, that they have some coverage and they don't get wiped out. And that's pretty important, especially today. Additionally, consumers will have another option. Insurers, doctors, and other medical providers will have the opportunity to offer medical care in an open marketplace. The legislation allows patients to keep their children enrolled as well. Right now, most plans cut them off at the age of 25, their children. This will expand it to age 30, so long as they're still single and have no dependents. So it's 5 more years of coverage at a much, much lower rate. Families and individuals will now have hope. And that's really what it's all about. Give them hope. Do something nice for them. Isn't that a refreshing change of pace? With all due respect to the two speakers that were here last night, after a while it got a little antagonistic. And I could kind of tell maybe these guys spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C. Well, we do it differently here in Florida. We really do. Mr. Cotterell can tell you that. I mean, it is a different way of doing things, and it's why we're having the success that we are. As I said, it will virtually include no state funds. The taxpayers have already paid their bill. Thank you very much. You know, our state budget is enormous. It's been reduced because of the current economic times, but it's still about $66 billion a year. That's a lot of money. In 1986 alone, it was $16 billion. And just in that short period of time, it's gone to $66 billion. So there's a lot of money out there. We just have to invest it wisely, and we have to be smart with how we spend it. And so long as we are, we'll be able to continue to provide the services people want and deserve and expect and should have. Good education, good roads, and now health care. It's important for us to keep doing that and work harder for them. Let me wrap up by telling you that we did it, as I mentioned earlier, by working together. We didn't care who got the credit. We just wanted to make sure who got the benefit. And the beneficiaries are the people of our state. And when we keep our eye on that ball, nobody loses. Everybody wins. And again, I know it's a different way of doing things, but I'm very proud of this legislature. I'm very proud of our administration and the hard work and the time that they have put in. Because without that dedication and that hard work and, frankly, those good hearts, these good, positive changes would not be happening in Florida. And I believe it's a role model for the country. I was interviewing with a journalist yesterday when I first got here, and I told him, you know, maybe someday Cover Florida can become Cover America, and we can do something smart that is efficient, that does provide the services people need, and does it in a way that truly is affordable. I mean, we've seen all kinds of ideas about how to provide health care to more people, and everything I've ever seen has been the most complicated stuff that nobody can understand. This is simple, to the point, and direct. And I believe that government should always be that way. You know, a lot of people think that government is complicated. I'm a big Ronald Reagan fan. And I remember Reagan always said, it's not complicated. It really isn't. It's trying to do what's right for the people and doing it in a way that they can understand, and they're smarter than anybody in government on any given day, I can assure you, and making sure that you deliver for them, that you uphold that oath. And they're counting on us. I first got elected to office in 1992. And I felt truly blessed by being able to serve in a very privileged business called public service. And it is a service. And as a senator knows, when people vote for you, they count on you. You talk about things during the course of a campaign. And if you actually go ahead and do them, you make their hearts sing. And if you don't, and you reverse course, you break their hearts. Well, here in Florida, we're not about breaking hearts. We want to bring them joy and bring them hope, and improve the quality of their lives. Thank you very much for being here. God bless you.
Thank you, Governor Crist, and thank you particularly for helping us get back on time with our schedule, which, as you undoubtedly noticed, is very tight. But our first panel today really reflects the many different points of view that we'll hear today from a variety of individuals. But the four panelists who will join me shortly here are all leaders within the realms in which they operate. Let me quickly introduce them. John Engler, the three-time tax-cutting governor of Michigan, is today the president of the National Association of Manufacturers, which has a critical interest in health care that stems from the 14 million Americans that are employed in U.S. Manufacturing. Professor Regina Hertzlinger, who is a professor at the Harvard Business School and author of three books on health care and often characterized as the godmother of consumer-driven health care. William Novelli, our third panelist, retired from the famously successful public relations firm he founded and which bore his name, Porter Novelli, to devote himself to the public service of CEO of the AARP. And looking out on the interests of all those individuals over 50 years old, there may be a few of you in the room. And our fourth panelist is Andy Stern, who rose through the ranks of the Service Employees International Union to become its president in 1996. It's one of the fastest growing unions in America, indeed the hemisphere, and healthcare is among the top priorities for its 2 million members. Jim Barnes, who is a political correspondent at National Journal, will moderate this session. How many of you are familiar with National Journal? Well, I would tell you, if you're interested in politics, if you're interested in health policy, energy, economics, immigration across the board, it's a weekly journal on federal policymaking, and you must see it and read it. I'll tell Jim something that he probably does not know. I spent 10 years at the National Journal. I joined its original staff in 1969 and stayed there for 10 years, held every job in the place, including the editorship, and left a decade later. It's a special journal, and I really encourage you all to take a look at it. With that, Jim, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. The panel here, the title of this particular panel is Fixing What's Broken Without Breaking What Works. And, of course, that all rings a familiar bell for many of us. That's very similar to the principle that gets drilled into all incoming doctors at medical school, which is first, do no harm. But certainly I think we'd agree that our healthcare system is not functioning as well as we as a country would like it. And so what I'd like to do is first turn to our panelists here, and this is a great panel representing business, the elderly, American workers, and the academy. So I'd like to turn to first Governor Engler here just to ask him what he sees as a couple of the priorities that need to be front and center in health care reform. Governor?
Well, thank you very much. And I do, from a business perspective, pay close attention to not breaking what does work in the sense that we've got a system that we just can't afford it. That's the real problem with it. But for business, so much of the manufacturers of America do provide health insurance and want to continue to provide health insurance. We just can't pay for it. And the cross-subsidization that takes place there is pretty significant. One of the places I'd start is picking up on what Ivan talked about. On the technology side, there's no question that health IT, and Ivan used a very big number today, but we think it is north of $100 billion in savings that's available. And part of what has made so many systems work better, it has been transparency and knowledge. And we do think that deployment and wringing administrative costs out is very important in terms of figuring out where some of the gaps are and also in finding some of the money. We're over $2 trillion in cost of a healthcare system today. That's a lot of money, and if we could get that money on the need. And there was an interesting study in the Wall Street Journal recently showing that taking the American population, sort of dividing it into five sort of equal sets of by income, and then looked at the healthcare expenditure per group, and surprisingly, it was in the same ballpark for each of those, but obviously funded very, very differently. And from a business perspective, the technology side would be very, very important. And to work on a system then that is able to work better for the remainder. And again, the points that both the Governor and Ivan Seidberg made in the earlier presentations this morning are important, that we think a wellness and prevention agenda has to be much more ubiquitous all across American healthcare. We think that there is an ability in our system through promoting additional choices and competition to really get back to something the professor will talk about, and that's really much more consumer ownership of their own care and consumer-driven than decision-making.
Regina?
Well, that's a very important question, and I think Mr. Seidenberg's and Governor Crist's presentation were just fantastic. But to home in on the priorities, I'd like to elucidate what I view the problem as being. And, of course, we have fabulous quality of care and very promising technology, great doctors, great hospitals. But we do have, as probably the richest country that ever existed in the world, about 50 million people who lack health insurance. We also have very erratic quality, so that nearly 300,000 people get killed every few years by hospital errors. Now, why did these things occur? Well, one of the reasons has to do with the third major problem with healthcare that's not talked about much, and that is that healthcare threatens the economic viability of the United States. When General Motors says that it spends $1,500 per car and Toyota says it spends $100 per car on health care, clearly that sets up an almost unsurmountable competitive barrier for General Motors and for the other great American companies that Governor Engler's organization represents, and other companies that are not in the manufacturing space. We also have yet another public policy problem. The fact that American companies that pay for health insurance, because of the high cost of health insurance, and because we have this unique funding structure where it is employers rather than consumers or government that pays for health insurance, they set up an almost insurmountable global competitiveness barrier. Second problem is the problem of job lock. You know that virtually all the growth in jobs in the American economy comes from small businesses. Most of the uninsured work for small businesses. These small businesses cannot afford to offer their employees health insurance. And because of our peculiar tax status, when an individual wants to buy health insurance, they can only use after-tax income to do that. So it becomes much more costly for the uninsured employed to buy health insurance on their own. How many people are working for big companies who, as a matter of public policy, we would like to see working for small companies because of this strange tax status? So what are the priorities? I think we have to get employers out of the business of buying health insurance, and we have to enable consumers to get into the business of buying health insurance. It is an essential for the survival of the U.S. economy. How do we do that? Well, we have to straighten out this crazy tax code so that right now, employers are burdened with buying health insurance because they can use pre-tax income, whereas if Harvard University were to cash me out and give me back the $15,000 of my salary they now use to buy my health insurance, half my salary. Just checking. It's early in the morning, you know, a woman's voice. I could only use after-tax money to do that. I think there's broad bipartisan support on that. Secondly, if you create a consumer-based market, how do people shop? We don't know anything. So clearly we need to have much greater transparency in the market so that people will know, is this doctor better on the basis of real data, not because my Aunt Fanny told me so, than the other kind of doctor? And in addition to that, what we need is payment reform. This is a real propeller head subject, but the healthcare system is virtually the only industry in the U.S. where the U.S. government dictates the prices. the way it dictates prices leads to gross misallocation of capital and a lack of interest in keeping people healthy because the providers, wonderful as they are, they get paid only for treating sick people, not for keeping people healthy. Those are the three priorities.
Before I go to Bill, I just want to ask Governor Engler, do all employers want to get out of the healthcare business?
Oh, I think if the system was just laid out, it would be a wonderful option for employers. Employers have an interest in seeing their employees with health care, and they don't want to be in a situation where the lack of health care in their workplace would be a competitive disadvantage, and they'd lose that key worker or workers to the business across the street. But I think employers care about their employees and whether or not they've got coverage, but as I said, it's unaffordable, so the system has to change.
Bill, what are your priorities?
Well, first, I want to start with sort of a scene setter, and the scene setter is that the system is really broken, number one. Number two, there's virtually no low-hanging fruit. You would think there would be. You'd think there'd be some no-brainers, but you can find controversy over virtually anything. And so one way to think about this might be we're not going to be able to transform this gigantic system. I mean, that's not how Congress works. That's not how we work. What we need to do, therefore, is take big steps, but take them in sequence. And we can discuss what those big steps are. We can order them so we can agree on them. But that's sort of the way to go here. And do things maybe that are not as controversial up front and more controversial as we go along. The first step is this whole concept of an information infrastructure. And the governor and you, Regina, have already talked about it. But what that does is, it gives us health IT, which we need to help to fix the system. Part of it is this idea of evidence-based research. If we don't know what works and reward what works, we're going to be as fouled up forever as we are today. You know, the idea that somewhere between a third and 40% of care is inappropriate, I mean, we can't keep paying for that. So we need that information infrastructure. You would think that would be a no-brainer, but unfortunately it isn't. The second thing is all the talk has been about coverage, I mean, through the Democratic primaries, even today, and we do need to do something about coverage, but that gets controversial. So one thought is that we can make progress with coverage without, getting too deeply into it. So let's use existing systems. For example, we've got to do SCHIP. The Congress has got to tackle SCHIP early next year. We've got many, many people unenrolled who are eligible for Medicaid, low-income people with respect to Medicare. We take those three systems and we get these people enrolled and we work together on this. We could solve maybe, I don't know, the professor can tell us, but a quarter of the uninsured problem. And then the third area is this whole area of chronic disease management. That's where the money is. There's tremendous money there to be saved. And a medical home is a good first step. We need to do other things. We need to focus on end of life. We need policy change there, education there. So I would say that the information infrastructure, a coverage step, and then this whole concept of chronic disease management are three good ways to sort of bring people together.
Andy, do you agree with any of these priorities, or do you have some new ideas?
Well, I would just say just to add some controversy in the middle of the political system. One is I've been on a lot of panels, in fact, with many of the people in here, and I think the one thing we know is this is no longer a matter of policy. It really is about politics and leadership. You know, we've had discussions for 50 years. There's been more papers, panels, and proposals in this field than any other field, and we know now two things. Costs continue to explode. Quality continues to erode. Access continues to decline. And the one thing we now are convinced of, the longer you wait, the worse it gets. That's the one thing we've proven about this discussion. Two is we've proven that as much as I agree with Bill that things should be simple, ask Senator Coburn when we gets up here why we don't have information technology, because things aren't simple. And I think what we're seeing now, whether it was in base closings, whether it's in restructuring Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and our economy, in moments of crisis you can make big change, not little change. It is no easier to make incremental change. I think we've proven that in healthcare, SCHIP, everything else, for a period of time. So what is it about the politics and the leadership? You know, when Harry and Louise beat Bill and Hillary, I think what we all now agree, no one won. America lost. That was a moment of change. We failed to meet the challenge of change, and our country lost. And as we now know, America is the only nation on earth that puts the price of health care on the cost of its products and competes against companies around the world that don't. It is the stupidest economic plan in the 21st century in a competitive global economy. And so I think we're at a moment of fundamental change. I think this is not a Democratic problem. It's not a Republican, business, labor, consumer, government. It's an American problem. It's a problem for our kids. It's a problem for our families. It's a problem for our economy. And I think America is ready to make that change if we have the right kind of political leadership. We saw it get very close in California, the largest economy, seventh largest economy in the world, the largest state in our country. Business, labor, government, insurance, the pharmaceutical company came this close to finding a midterm solution, not a final solution, which I agree has to go to not having an employer-based system. So I think we're at a moment of change, and we shouldn't get shy. We should elect a president and tell him, like Divided We Fail is telling him, like Better Healthcare Together, which has SEIU, Walmart, Intel, Partnership for Quality Care, Chronic Disease Coalition, we're ready for fundamental change. We're Americans. We can solve this problem. Every other country in the world is, and we owe it to our kids.
We may not have gotten the kind of healthcare reform that some people were looking for in California, but we certainly did get big innovation in healthcare in the home state where Regina teaches in Massachusetts. And I think that notwithstanding the fact that the governor who brought that initiative to fruition walked away from it a little bit in his campaign for the Republican presidential nomination, Governor Romney. But it does seem to have been a plan that has inspired actually some of the Democratic plans in terms of having a mandate. On the other hand, the question is the best way to get Americans health care through mandates or is there other ways to provide access? One of the things that I note in the political system, and I'd like you all to reflect on this, is that it does seem to me, though, that the debate among our political leaders has shifted a little bit. We no longer have, on the Democratic side, calls for single payers. We have some calls for single payer, but I believe outside of Dennis Kucinich, none of the major Democratic candidates were single-payer advocates this time around. Likewise, on the Republican side, I think we see a greater and greater appreciation that everybody's got to get covered somehow, that we can't really fix this system by leaving so many people uninsured. So with that, I'd be interested in just your all's views on the issue of a mandate, whether it's an employer mandate, employer mandates, or and individual mandates. Governor, how do employers feel about being told what they have to do?
Well, one of the cost drivers, of course, is that people who aren't insured are still getting care. They're getting it in the wrong place. They're getting it in the emergency room. They're getting it in some high-cost locations. They're getting at times even frequency of care. I mean, Bill's point, and everyone here would agree, and the tenor of the whole day is that wellness and prevention ought to be priorities, and the logic of only paying to treat the sick it gets us not in a spot where we don't want to be. As somebody who's run for 12 years a Medicaid program, and then was involved in the implementation of SCHIP and trying to get people signed up for SCHIP, it is very hard to understand how you can't get people. And then you went out into the highways and the byways to get people. In the process, we did expand slightly Medicaid roles. But there really is, with the two of those programs, no child in America today that it can be argued should be without coverage, because the programs are there. There are lots of delivery system issues. I think that the mandate, in my understanding of California, everybody was almost there until they started tallying up the costs, and then they couldn't allocate the costs, and so it didn't work. Part of the reason that we're pretty passionate about trying to understand where the money goes today and how you rationalize the system is that with $2 trillion, there's a lot of money out there. That's double any other nation in the world, so it seems to me with that amount of money, getting the money where the problems are is an important thing to be thinking about before we start to think that this takes many hundreds of billions of dollars or tens of billions of dollars more. So, and in the course of doing that, if you can make the mandate can be made to work, and we avoid what I'm worried about, if you take Medicare and Medicaid as systems, they're publicly dominated systems. Government makes a lot of the rules. Neither of those two are really funded for their actual costs. So if somebody's in those systems, then the private pay or the other insurance systems are picking it up. And so that seems to me to be part of the logic that would worry you about creating a brand new other public system for people who are currently uncovered that's funded, say, at a Medicaid or Medicare, even a Medicaid, which is slightly better, Medicaid rate, and then have that shift of costs back over to the private sector, because it seems to me that doesn't get us where we want to be.
Regina, should we be inspired by Massachusetts?
Massachusetts is, of course, in all ways highly inspirational. I urge you all to come, and as Governor Chris so eloquently said, bring a lot of money with you, because we need it. This health insurance subsidies under Mitt Romney's very visionary plan will clock in. There are already at about $800 million, and they're clearly going to exceed $1 billion. You know, a billion here, a billion there. Soon you're talking real money. Should we have an employer mandate or should we have an individual mandate? I think people increasingly want to see universal coverage in the United States, whatever side of the aisle, not everybody, but there's more and more agreement about that. The question is, how the heck do you find the money to do it? If you mandate that employers offer health insurance, that is incredibly bad public policy. We already have a major competitiveness problem because American employers are among the few in the world who have to factor the cost of health care into their prices. Now, if you're a small employer and you're not offering health insurance and you have this mandate, what the heck are you going to do? Well, one thing you could do is lay off workers because it's essentially a payroll tax. Or you go to part-time workers, excuse me, or you substitute capital for labor. Any of those things that distort the business decisions of the great business people, men and women that we have in the United States, is clearly something we don't want to do. So do we want to go to an individual mandate? Well, there are countries that fund universal coverage through an individual mandate, where consumers are required to buy health insurance. So they're not single-payer countries. It's not the government that runs the healthcare system. It's the consumers who run the healthcare system. And they're non-wacko countries. It's the country of Switzerland, the country of the Netherlands, very productive, very smart, admirable kinds of economies. However, individual mandate, to me, makes a lot more sense. I don't see the political will behind it.
Bill?
Well, we know, obviously, Massachusetts has both, and they tried to make it work, and they made the employer mandate as low as they could. Last year in California, you know, the Schwarzenegger plan had both. It had an individual mandate and an employer mandate. And the logic of the individual mandate was you're not going to be able to require insurance companies to insure everybody. They're going to continue to cherry pick unless everybody's in the system. Otherwise, young people and others will only buy the insurance when they get sick. And that's not going to work for insurance companies. So there was logic there. I think that from a standpoint of an employer mandate, you know, Andy and I are both part of Divided We Fail, the National Federation of Independent Business, which is medium and small business is part of it. They said, no, we're not going to accept an employer mandate. They fought it in California. They will fight it elsewhere. I think the governor will have a point of view on it as well. And so from a standpoint of logic and policy, you can say that, well, maybe an individual or an employer mandate will work. Maybe it won't work. Politically, it's enormously inflammatory. It's just not going to be a political lift that I think we can make.
Andy?
So, you know, one thing I like to quote Secretary Leavitt, because I think we need to appreciate we don't have a healthcare system, and we keep talking about we have a healthcare sector. And it's almost like if you took Walmart and UPS and disaggregated it into a million small businesses and a million small package delivery firms with no technology, no information, you would have our healthcare system. It is totally non-interoperable. Our nurses in Iowa, when they transfer a patient from the university hospital to another hospital, put the medical records in the ambulance. You know, it's like unbelievable that that's how we transfer data in the 21st century. So we need to build a system out of this which deals with all the information technology, and everybody has to be in the system. You can't have a system with 50 million people out of it. It's just not going to work, and you have to fund the system, right? I mean, we would all agree on that, and I think then the question is, let's just make some hard decisions. I know it sounds, you know, very simple, but let's make some hard decisions of how we're going to do that. Everybody's got to be in. Somehow the country's going to have to pay for it, and it's going to have to be interoperable. It has to have wellness and prevention and all the things, transparency, that just make things work. I mean, and we can see it in business what works, and we just have to conceptualize it. Last thing I'll say, it's really interesting for me, for all the criticism that government takes. As soon as the economy tanks, you know, we nationalize banks, we nationalize Fannie Mae, Ginnie Mae, we insure AIG. So this whole kind of market, let's let the market work. I think we're living through a moment that free markets don't work as quite as well as we think, and they're not going to work any better in healthcare.
Hopefully we won't have people speculating on healthcare plans the way they were speculating on mortgages. But I think if I heard everybody correctly up here, employer mandates, not such a great idea. Individual mandates, yes, we wouldn't necessarily agree on how to pay for them right now. But is that a fair? I mean,
I would just say I think employer mandates are not the best way to fund the system.
Right.
But absent any other way to fund the system, we should fund it through employer mandates.
But you're open to the idea of individual mandates?
Oh, totally.
What?
Totally.
Totally. Okay. Great. So I have a little area of consensus here. The presidential candidates obviously do have a lot. Will have one of these men will be the president, and he will have a lot to say about this. When I was looking through some of their healthcare plans, one thing I did notice is both Senator McCain and Senator Obama favor the importation of safe or FDA approved drugs. Is that going to, would that make a significant step in easing our healthcare burden, and are there any dangers or downsides to that, Governor?
Well,
you probably had some people in your state who went to Canada to.
Yeah, we have one United States senator in our state that keeps going over there, but you know, it really is a sort of a hollow and symbolic gesture, because I do think if we look at the pharmaceutical industry in this country, it is far and away one of our leading research sectors, the world leader. And I look at China today. I mean, this past week there was a milk scare, but there's no question there have been plenty of pharmaceutical issues and adulterated drugs, and we want to maintain a strong grip on the supply chain, but then reimportation of drugs sort of blows that up, so it runs at odds with public safety. So I think it you know, you'd have a trade-off there. Reimportation might get you, for some people, a cheaper product. It also will put you at greater risk, because there ought to be some thought given to that. I also think that if we aren't, and in fact, the Senate's got in front of it today a bill that would further allow for crackdown on counterfeit products and intellectual property theft. I mean, I think we ought to be defending our intellectual property, and that would include a pharmaceutical drug from the knockoffs and the thefts around the world, and we would want, it seems to me, to encourage that sector to continue to come up with game-changing therapies. And if we're serious about a wellness agenda, that's also, it seems to me, part of that. So I don't think simply reimportation. I think it's been much more of an interesting political debate than it is any potential solution for the fundamental problems that we're talking about. And for the politics, I think regardless of who's elected, it was and Andy made this point. I mean, it is, you know, the policies are kind of out there. It takes leadership and takes decisions, and it's going to take Republicans and Democrats working together because we've seen it. Somebody, one of the doctors, a doctor in Atlanta, I think she was from last night, asked this question. I mean, 8 years of President Clinton, 8 years of President Bush, they've had at times the Congress entirely their way. They've had it hostile. It doesn't make any difference. We still didn't get anything done, and I think the bottom line is they're all going to have to, they're going to have to come together, and can presidential leadership, whoever it is, get that point done, and can you build the coalition? And I think if we do that and we talk about fundamental reform, the reimportation issue is sort of a little issue over on the side, and we are not supportive of that in the sense at the manufacturers group, simply because we think that the companies ought to be able to protect the supply chain and ensure the integrity of their product in the marketplace.
Any other views on this? Regina, Bill?
I think the pharmaceutical industry is a very important American industry. We are on the verge of a breakthrough in technology in medicine that is as important as the Industrial Revolution was to the creation of the middle class in the United States. Personalized medicine, which came about with the unraveling of the genome, will enable the creation of diagnostics and medicines that are specific to the diseases that each of you may have, including me, which are caused by unique mutations in our genes. This kind of therapeutic intervention will actually cure diseases which up to now we've just been able to palliate. The United States is by far the world leader in the extraordinarily expensive research that this kind of technological breakthrough requires. And it will be not only a great boon to civilization, but a great boon to our economy if we are the leaders in this astonishing technological breakthrough. I went to MIT, if you can't tell. I really like technology. On the other hand, we pay for a lot of the drug development because the United States pays much higher prices for its drugs than other countries. The pharmaceutical manufacturers are between a rock and a hard place. If they go to a single-payer economy like the UK or Canada, they're fighting with an 800-pound gorilla who says, here's my price, take it or leave it. Hopefully, reimportation will put some sort of political push and require more sanity on the part of these other countries who now are so recalcitrant and essentially force the pharmaceutical manufacturers to the politically and economically unpalatable situation of charging Americans so much more for the drugs.
Bill?
Real quickly, I agree with both positions. We favor importation. And the reason we do is the very point that the professor just made. We need to have safe importation of drugs. We need to have safe importation of baby food. The FDA's got to get its act together. But the real key here is the way to make drugs more affordable and more efficacious is I bet half this room consists of physicians. The wise use of medications, really focusing on adherence, focusing on generics, these areas are where the savings lie. Importation is a good idea. Having the government negotiate for drugs, buying pools among states, these are all good ideas. But we can make the most progress in terms of drugs and cost effectiveness if we really focus on wise use of medications.
Another point of consensus, to some extent, between Senator Obama and Senator McCain does revolve around this notion of information technology. Both of their healthcare plans put premiums on having medical providers to sort of report out data on cost and nurse-patient ratios and quality outcomes. This is that aspect of the healthcare program. That aspect of healthcare, I think, is something that's seen to empower consumers. And that's why I think both McCain and Obama, you know, endorsed this idea. I mean, is how much of a contribution would that make, or are there some limitations? Regina?
I think that enabling transparency is enormously important. We cannot have an efficient industry in any part of the United States without transparency, and we don't know anything. The question is, how is it done? The devil or God or somebody is always in the details. Is it going to be a top-down, government-centered, ran down the throats of providers, of doctors and hospitals and nurses and technicians, or is it going to be a bottom-up movement, an organic movement, where the people who are the key stakeholders in the industry are the ones who shape what transparency means? We have to work out. That's not a trivial detail.
So, I mean, it just seems to me we're looking at government in the wrong role. You know, government buys over half the health care in this country. Forget them as a regulator, a legislator. They happen to be a purchaser. And I think they have every right to demand as a purchaser. What any purchaser does is certain standards, whether it's supply chain, whether it's information technology, that may be called ramming down. It may just be called lets the market work, that the purchasers have a right to make demands. And I think the government should demand information technology and demand that anybody wants to do business with them publish the results in some way that doctors and everyone can try to agree upon. But, you know, the Institute for Medicine, people have all kinds of answers of how to do this fairly, or as fairly as we now know how. And it just seems nuts that we're spending $500 billion a year or whatever by the government, and they're not demanding information technology.
Especially when, and Governor Thompson may address this later because he's been out in the forefront, and Governor Leavitt right behind him. And the three of us, along with you know, former Governor Childs from this state, and Roy Romer was another one that was very active in the governor's group in the 90s, where we were doing welfare reform. The Medicaid reform debate was raging at the time. But it does seem to us that CMS today, with the role that it plays with Medicare and Medicaid, is in a perfect position to do a lot of standardization. It authorizes state Medicaid system upgrades, and yet has never really sort of insisted on the standardization on each of those. They've looked at one-off improvements all over the country. That's an obvious starting point. The other thing that states have done in terms of, I mean, I think it was mentioned a medical home. We think that's very important. A medical home would no doubt have a medical record. You start that, or you should. Most of the states developed immunization registries, so we get the child in the hospital getting the first shot, first entry on that child's record. In the case of the Engler family with Michelle and John and three daughters moving from Michigan to Virginia, as we did, you know, we still had to go back to pediatricians and get records and have copies sent and then have to furnish them to school for PE or for camp or for sports. I mean, as opposed to doing all this stuff electronically, having an attestation that it's all done and good. I mean, it's all this transaction that's built in, and this all could be tied together. It's not the idea that you force everybody into the same system. And in fact, one of the problems is vendor world out there has got a lot of different systems, but there clearly is a kind of a middleware approach that brings all this stuff together, much like Quicken might do with your financial records. Everybody's comfortable with that, or a bill payer function on some of these banks where you're bringing in all kinds of financial data. Numbers are all smaller these days, but I mean, there it is. And you can make that work, and that ought to be done. And part of the demand, I always cite an article I read in one of Bill's magazines. We had 600,000 medical tourists about a year ago, I think, is when this ran. And I figure there's 600,000 Americans who care so much about cost and quality, they're willing to make a decision based on rather sketchy information that they'll go to New Delhi or to Thailand or someplace around the world to have a procedure done. and that they're comfortable that the cost's a lot less and the quality is as great or greater, that just tells me how this will explode. And I think it's literally the estimates that this is going to take years to do are simply wrong. It's like flipping the switch on the health internet. Once this goes, it's going to explode, and in 12 months, it'll stun people what's there. But the government has the role of helping definitionally with some of this, and then HIPAA, which we used to complain about, now, you know, oddly enough, in the last few years, as we talked to Health IT, became our greatest friend because it says it's my record, and there's an obligation for, yeah, I get to control it, and it's supposed to be private. Unlike, say, some people's emails, I guess. Today here, but, anyway.
Well, we've talked about some possibilities here, but I think we all understand that there are lots of obstacles, and I would be interested in hearing from all four of you before we go to questions. What you see are some of the biggest impediments to reform. Bill?
Well, I think there are at least three, and I'll give you my three favorite ones. Number one is political gridlock and partisanship and lack of political leadership. You know, to quote Andy Stern, leadership counts. Now, we see this gridlock in Tallahassee and Albany and Sacramento, but it's particularly bad, I mean really toxic, in Washington. It's not a mistake that all these politicians run against Washington, whether they're in the system or not. This is a major, major impediment that we have to face up to. Number two is public worry, public angst. And the public is essentially worried about two things. Number one, they're very worried about costs. They feel like they're one illness away from bankruptcy. They're going to lose their coverage. Their adult children don't have coverage. They fear this. But the second thing they fear is losing what they already have. And we need to bring the public along, and they have a right to be afraid, given the system as we've just described it. And then the third big problem is what I'll call every special interest for itself. Now, back in 93, 94, in the Clinton effort to reform health care, you know, it was a colossal mess. Even the people who supported the Clintons were trying to get their extra dime out of it. And there was no critical mass of people who agreed on things. And today we have all these coalitions, we have all these people working together. But when it comes down to it, are we going to have the big players working together? Are they going to basically say, we agree on health IT, do it? Or are we going to have continued special interest efforts to protect their money? There's a lot of money involved here. And if we don't have the special interests working together, we're not going to solve the gridlock problem.
Obstacles, Andy?
The perfect being the enemy of the good. Which I think that everybody's second choice has been to do nothing as opposed to get something done. And the third thing, I think we just have to realize this is just way too complicated an issue for Congress to legislate. And, you know, you're going to hear from Tom Daschle a little later today. And if you think about how we did base closings and many other things, if you watch what the Federal Reserve Board could do now, God thank us we're not asking Congress to try to figure out what to do now, because we'd be having hearings for the next 6 months. It seems we're at a place, you know, and he talks about creating a Federal Health Reserve Board, where we take a lot of this ideas, information, knowledge, and we give it to a wise group of nonpartisan special interest people, and they make presentations to Congress about things that could be done, vote them up, vote them down. But we just cannot. It is way too complicated. It moves way too fast to try to legislate healthcare, disease by disease, information technology choices. You know, that is not what Congress got elected to do, and we really need to centralize somewhere some really smart people like the Federal Reserve Board that are nonpartisan, nonpolitical, and given some authority to make some decisions.
A resounding endorsement of the Federal Reserve Board from a gentleman who's been a great leader of the American labor movement. Regina?
We spend $2 trillion on health care. So what is $2 trillion? The mind boggles. $2 trillion is about the GDP of China. So that's what the American people spend on health care. It's all their money. It's money they pay in taxes or monies that they give up in salaries so that their employers or their union funds can buy health insurance on their behalf. What do we get for this money? We have no idea. There's no accountability. Why is that? It's because the people who receive these monies, the hospitals, the physicians, the insurers, the U.S. Congress, they're in hog heaven. We gave them $2 trillion and we didn't ask them to be accountable for this. To get any kind of reform means that somehow we have to blow up this very cozy status quo. Who's going to blow it up? Well, the employer community, which is, I'm sorry, Governor, I don't mean to charge you with total responsibility for that, but the employer community in 1996, finally, the tipping point came as far as health care costs went, and they said, we've got to have a solution. Our health care costs are greater than our profits, and they're growing at much faster rates. We've got to do something. We went to a solution. We went from almost no penetration of managed care to almost 100%. Turned out that silver bullet was like a bullet to the head, but we moved very fast. Once the employer community said, look, we're dying. The economy of the United States is going to die. They're the only, in my amateurish political calculus, the only force that can break this cozy cronyism that we now have that's controlling our $2 trillion is the economy. The employer speaking up, the union speaking up and saying, you're killing me. I can't survive.
Governor?
Virginia, I tend to agree with this, and I've worked with the employer committee now at the NAMP for 4 years because it's a difference of just like everybody's got their priorities in the political process, depending on where they sit. I mean, you've had some companies who hope that somehow there was a solution. I mean, even to the point of desperation, maybe I'll take a government-run system if I can shift my cost off. But so there is a split. I think on things like health IT, my argument has been for 4 years, come on, we can do this.
Right.
I mean, we've built these relationships with all kinds of other suppliers to major companies, global networks, and we can't do this. And there's been efforts. Dossier, Intel was very involved with a number of large employers. Now Microsoft's got health rolled out on the health record. There's got to be some way to basically get that health internet to go live. It would be great if you could get government and I think it's some state governments would partner with some companies and say this is what we're going to do. It's been very, very hard to get somebody to take the plunge. Part of the problem at the corporate level is that, with due respect to HR people who might be in the room, unless it's got a CEO sponsorship, there are bastions of status quo inside every company, and many of them are in the HR benefits offices. I mean, that's what they know, and some of this transparency makes some of that duty less. I think that Andy's point that the perfect being the enemy of the better is really relevant to this whole debate because I do think it's been very hard. I think it is partisanship that gets in the way, but it is that it can be overcome by leadership. I don't know that there's, and I think that's one of the things people worry about Ted Kennedy. Well, you know where he is. You may not agree with him on certain issues, but he has been a bit of a force of nature at times when he got his focus on something in the Senate. And the prospect of him not being in the Senate in full, robust health on this kind of an issue is daunting. Then, as who steps up, and in the Congress generally, and this will be a question other panelists who've been part of that will do better than I. But are there the people with the capacity to do this? Senator Wyden's actually got a bill that tends to bring a lot of different people together. He's worked with Senator Bennett on that, and that may well be a starting point. But also, an administration is going to have to come to the table prepared to talk specifics, too. It can't be one where we're all going to have meetings and let's reason together. I mean, people actually have to put proposals down, and those have to be then met with other proposals, and there's got to be a process to sort it through. I think having a conversation is about like having this panel. At the end of the day, we'll have maybe informed ourselves of a point or two and walked away, but we don't have it fixed. And whether I'd be fine on a base closure type of approach too, but I do think that one of the problems the employer community has in this debate, if you start with 40 5 million or 47 or 50 million, however many are uninsured, you've got that out there. You've got the Medicaid system, and then there's all those problems, and that's 40-some millions. And so by the time you're done with those, and if you're thinking that's all extra money, by the time you get to the employer community, I'm not sure there's help. I'm afraid there's a bill. And so we've actually backed away from the goal where we need to be. But I also am cognizant in a lot of congressional districts, the biggest employer in community after community after community is the health care system. Yeah. And when you say, well, gee, utilization rates look to be 50% or less at your facility, maybe we're going to have that facility and this facility come together. We've now got a jobs issue, and you're asking the congressman to vote to eliminate jobs, and those get hard. Those are hard votes to get.
Would anybody out there like to help me out and ask some questions? Do we have microphones? Somebody, why don't we just? I'll just go from here, gentleman right here at that second table. If somebody can get him a mic by any chance.
I'll just talk loud.
All right, go ahead. Just talk loud.
There is an assumption that started with Mr. Seidenberg and Governor Crist that I think any physician in this room won't disagree with me, and that is that health care insurance is the answer. Well, let me tell you where the rubber meets the road. I'm an emergency physician. I withdrew from the hospital. I do urgent and emergent care as a house call practice. I deliver care for about a third of what it would cost in an emergency room. When somebody needs that hospital, I'll take them there. I'll load them up and take them. I withdrew from the insurance game, too. So I give my patients a receipt with insurance codes on it. And what I've found is, and I would like Mr. Seidenberg or Governor Crist to actually take one of these receipts and try to get reimbursed from their insurance company. Because the first thing that game does, deny. Deny a second time. The codes aren't right. The codes are obsolete. By the time you finally get paid some percentage of what you actually did, it's unrecognizable, and you paid all that money to your department who handles your billing. So we can't just assume get insurance for everybody and everything is fixed, because as physicians, we can't stay in the business with this game as it's currently played.
I hear that. Do you have any reaction to...
Amen.
Yeah. I think the situation of physicians is quite dire in the United States, not appreciated how dire it is. Unfortunately, in my Harvard Business School class on innovating in healthcare, out of a class of 100, I have 20 physicians, and they're very fully trained physicians, so fully trained, they're nearly as old as I am. And I say, what the heck are you doing here? You have a mission, you know, being a physician, that's a mission. And you're so well prepared and you're so brilliant. And they say, I can't be a doctor anymore. The coding, coverage, and payment system that the insurance companies have set up is a real noose around physicians, and many of them are saying, like you, I've got to get out of here. So when we talk about payment reform, those are not just empty words. The payment system has to work in a way so that physicians say, God, I don't want to have five clerks helping me to do the billing. I've got to have an easy way to get paid. I'm all with you. Mm-hmm.
Yes, did somebody have a microphone?
Look,
okay, there's a microphone. Yes, sir. And then we'll come up to the front table. Yes, sir.
Maybe you can hand that.
Dr. Burke, private practice in Denver. The idea of getting employers out of paying for health insurance is a really great idea, but what kind of guarantee are we going to have that then they're going to pass on the cost savings to their employees as opposed to just making it more profits for the company?
Well, I think that the different proposals all are premised on the relationship. The government's providing some credit to the individual for that purchase or credit against their cost of health insurance. So it's not the idea that there's a complete walking away here on the part of employers. And as I said, I think employers have at least the National Association of Manufacturers, a group of a lot of major industrial employers. And interesting enough, I was going to make this point earlier, you'll give me a chance to do this. We're a $1.6, $1.7 trillion contribution to U.S. GDP. Healthcare is bigger than the entire manufacturing sector. And if our sector were a nation, we'd be the eighth largest nation in the world. So that's how big healthcare is. But the idea is Verizon's not talking about, they don't want to see their employees not covered by healthcare. And I would say that's true with lots of other members that we have. If overall reform seeks to cover, make sure that individually everybody has coverage, then at least under some of the proposals that are in the Congress, there's a way to help that family afford that. And then you get into like your HSA, FSA kinds of programs also, where you're going to allow some of that money to kind of roll forward too. And there's a lot of creative stuff that's been done already with sort of limited experiments. But you end up starting to create a real financial incentive for wellness and prevention then for a family. So,
back there, and then can somebody pass a microphone up to this table right here?
On the subject, Tom Benton, pediatrician, University of Florida, Gainesville. And payment reform and prevention are two subjects that I feel like could be addressed more. You know, if you get paid for every ear infection, then that's a certain reimbursement mechanism. But if you get paid to prevent the ear infection by giving immunizations or control the diabetes instead of doing the vascular surgery. So if y'all could comment on that, please.
Bill?
Just from a prevention standpoint, Ivan Seidenberg mentioned it. The governor mentioned it. We haven't talked enough about it. We could do a conference on prevention, and we should. There is a huge return on investment available to this country if we really got into prevention and wellness. The leaders in this area today are the corporations because they see a bottom line benefit to trying to keep their people well. I believe personally that we can do prevention and we can do it very effectively. Right now it is fragmented. It's a national embarrassment. If you just take tobacco control, you're in Florida. You know that tobacco control works. It worked in Florida. Then they zeroed out the budget, essentially. The Commonwealth Fund estimated that if we did what we already know how to do in terms of tobacco, we could save $200 billion over 10 years. That's just tobacco. That's not diabetes, obesity, hypertension, and so forth. We need a national private-public partnership that has some kind of congressional mandate to it and some kind of funding behind it, with a really coherent plan. We need to go after prevention. It's a little bit soft and fuzzy from a CBO standpoint, but if we do it, we will have a big payoff in 5 to 10 years.
Did we get a mic? Oh, here. I think Mike's coming right here, though. If you just wait a few seconds. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Priscilla Arnold. I represent the American Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgery, and our membership primarily deals with senior patients, number one, and number two is representative of small business. So we understand the pressures of small business. I'd like the panel to respond to their call, universal call for HIT, as to how the reality of that shall be funded in a small business that's under the economic pressures that you've described and then has a mandate to adopt HIT.
We have somebody here.
Well, I think it should be done. I think the Medicaid system, for example, this ought to be software that's literally given out. This has to be an open source system, and you're doing, and our offices are doing, running IT systems, and I think that this can be done over a period of time. The pharmaceutical, the prescribing industry is almost all digital. The labs are almost all digital today, so that's a question of tying those in. Larger hospitals, to me, Andy and I had this conversation about public education. I mean, we've got a lot of IT needs there, too, but sort of the two biggest public expenditures we got are the two poorest utilizers of technology to drive cost out and open up the system. And I think that we're not talking about I don't think it matters how you keep your records. There's a certain amount of information in those records that need to be on. It's my cataract, my surgery. I mean, some of that has to come and be available for my record, and I need to be able to ship it over to Dr. Virginia if she needs to see that in the future. And that shouldn't be. We've figured this out in every other area. I don't think the costs are near what they've been estimated to be.
Regina, quickly.
I think the real cost of IT is always in the implementation of IT. It's never the system cost. It's always getting that system to work. One of the big problems in IT for small physician practices and other small, very important providers of care has been the lack of that jaw-breaking term, interoperability. So as long as Aetna speaks French and United speaks German, you're going to be the one who has to do the translation. So a very important thing is to get them all to talk a common language. And although I am not one who thinks of government as a solution, more typically I think of it as a problem, I think that government assistance in getting over the costs of implementation is very appropriate.
Real quickly, sir.
I'm Andrew Byrne from the American College of Emergency Physicians. We saw 119 million patients last year, according to CDC. Only 12% of those were non-urgent. My question really relates to the myths that I'm hearing on the panel, which really scared the hell out of me. Amongst them, the IT issue that was just raised at the table, it's estimated we've heard 100 billion saved. But yet the implementation cost we've also seen is about $200 billion, and no one's talking about how to pay for that. No one's talking about the sacred cows. One-third of the Medicare budget is spent in the last 18 months of life. No one's talking about end-of-life care and whether to provide that care or not. There are other issues also that we're hearing about, and $80 billion is spent on defensive and tort related issues, and no one's talking about that either. So there is some money in the system, but there's a lack of political will, and we're just skirting around some of the real meaty issues that are important to discuss, and we're not hearing about it at all.
Anybody have a reaction to the?
Yeah, real quickly, I don't think we're skirting around anything. I mean, I spoke about end of life. You and I have talked about end of life. There's a lot of money there. Even more importantly, there's a lot of quality of life and quality of death issues there. And what we need there is both policy and education. The current policies are not sufficient or adequate. We need to change the whole end-of-life system in this country. That's something we can do. That is highly controversial, but we can do that. There's no question about it.
There are end-of-life issues, and there are end-of-panel issues. But I'm sure that some folks around here might be available. Do we still have a little more time for a little more Q&A? No. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to. It is an end of panel issue. Thank you. Let's have a nice round of applause for our panel here.
Well, even though I don't think it's pretty, there's just not enough time to talk about all those. So.
Let's probably exit the same.